This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
No! It can camouflage!
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Mr. Kim,
formaldehyde. Dirty formaldehyde. Pour him into the sink.
Welcome, everyone, to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we break down the science behind monsters, and in monster movies in particular. My name's Adam Hasek. I'm a disease ecologist at the University of Arkansas, soon to be a doctor, we hope, here in about a month or so. The defense is one month and 2 days from now, so that's fun. Joining me, as always, is Libby Young, the writer at Short Story Soup, our resident story expert, and continuity change maestro, and, of course, as always, Dave. Sam will not be joining us this week. Yeah, there was a troll outbreak in Norway this week, and Sam has been enlisted as, you know, one of their kind to hopefully be able to talk them down and cease the aggression.
Yeah, see, I thought when you said troll outbreak, that meant Sam got out.
I mean, that's what we're supposed to talk about that, but yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what happened.
It's more like the concept of Avatar, if you've ever seen the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So Sam's been sent in. We'll see how well he does with the troll people to see if he convinces them and gains their trust. And they feel like they're getting worse, like as things start to get warmer. I'm wondering if there is like a climate change impact that we might be seeing between these troll outbreaks, because it seems like it's every week with Sam now.
Yeah, there's a lot of studies equating, you know, the thermal reaction norms to the metabolic rates and activities of different animals. So as it's getting warmer, the trolls are probably getting angrier. And unfortunately, Sam doesn't have Sigourney Weaver to help him.
That
so
we know
we'll
of.
Have to see how this goes. Yeah. Anyway, this week we are covering The Host, the 2000X Bong Joon-ho monster movie, which is one of my favorite monster movies.
Mm-hmm.
A bit different on a rewatch this time, but apology in advance for the listeners. We have a much better mic setup this time, so we hope that sounds nicer.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also drinking coffee, so if you hear that, we apologize.
I want to go ahead and apologize. My pronunciation, I can't even say pronunciation,
so really
this is going to go great. Pronunciation of some of these names of the actors or character names might be pretty bad. So I do apologize. I will do my very best.
Do we have anything else before we get into the meat of what we thought about the movie?
No, I don't think so. Let's get locked in.
Hell yeah! Let's do this!
So in terms of the movie itself, so does someone want to give us a brief summary of the film?
Yeah, I can do that. So, first of all, this movie came out in 2006, back when little Libby graduated high school. This is a movie about, the start of the movie starts with, I'm doing a really good job.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I shouldn't do this.
The group of scientists dumping the formaldehyde down the drain?
Yes. So there's an evil American scientist ordering a Korean underling to dump all this formaldehyde from a medical examiner's office down the drain into the Han River, I believe.
Yes.
The poor guy tries to protest, saying this is bad, these need to be disposed of properly, and the evil American scientist says, no, dump it down the drain. So then you kind of see like a flash forward of 2 years later, two fishermen in the Han River, seeing something strange. Flash forward, I think, four more years later?
Another 4 years, I believe.
Another 4 years. And we have what I think is one of the best opening scenes of a movie.
100%.
Yeah, where you see the introduction of this family, Korean family, who works in like a little snack shop along the Han River. And a creature emerges from the water and just starts raining total destruction, upon these poor people that are just walking along the Han River. So the rest of the movie is about the daughter of, one of the family members getting kidnapped by this monster, and them going through and trying to launch a rescue attempt for this poor girl. Is there any more? Do you want to go more into detail of the summary, or
no? I think that too vague. I think the only thing there would be there is as in many monster movies or sci-fi movies, there is this vague yet menacing overarching government interference mm-hmm. or control going on in this movie. And in this case, it's the Korean government in conjunction with the U.S. military,
right.
which is a very common theme throughout this movie.
Yep. Coming up with the virus that they convince everybody the creature is contaminated with, hence the host. Even though they do repeat at the end that there is, in fact, no virus, it just seems like they're looking for an opportunity to use their special chemical, the Agent Yellow, to try and clear out as many creatures as they possibly can.
Yeah, I think as somebody who studies parasites for a living, I had some issues with, I mean, it's not really super important. It's just, if you know what to look for, they showed an image of a bacteria, not a virus, when they were showing their little infographic on the on the TV, like, look out for this virus. It was literally like the squiggly bacteria with the little cilia on the outside of it. You've seen it if you've ever seen a elementary or primary school textbook with an image of a bacteria. And they attribute it to a virus within 2 hours of this monster.
Not even.
It's a very quick thing, and you cannot detect a virus or any kind of organism within, even though a virus isn't, there's debate on if it is an organism or not. You can't detect something like that quickly. It takes a lot of work. Basically, what you're doing whenever you have these methods, and I think you would use PCR for this, which stands for polymerase chain reaction, where basically you have a piece of a genetic code that you're interested in. You throw it into a little vat. You multiply it a whole lot. And then you have a lot of DNA to work with, and you try to compare that to other genetic codes and figure out what it is. So basically, you have your giant tree of life on the wall, you throw this DNA at it, and you see where it sticks. There is a lot of DNA in this world, there is a whole lot of diversity on the tree of life, and the viruses aren't even on the tree of life because they're not alive. So them figuring this out within an hour is impossible.
I feel like given the level of Bong Joon-ho's detail that he usually gives his film, I would not be surprised if that was purposeful, that he showed a bacteria and not a virus.
Yeah,
that makes complete sense.
And it makes complete sense the more they get into it when, you know, there is no mm-hmm. virus that's detected. And yeah, the whole idea that one dude within 2 hours, also they only have one person, and they're like, oh, this guy has died. It's clearly a virus. And it's like, you have no other specimens. You haven't done any large sampling. You can't see viruses under the microscope because they keep saying, like, we've detected it on the blood smear. And it's like, no.
I'm not even a scientist, but my study shows that you seem 70% more authoritative if you're wearing a lab coat. And I am! Thank you so much! Woo! Not a scientist! There you go! Yeah!
Getting into our opinions on this film, what did everybody think?
I saw this movie back in about 2007, I think, and I loved it. This is probably about the sixth time I've seen this movie. We rewatched it this week. Man, I still like it. I think Bong Joon-ho is just such a fantastic storyteller, you know, both script-wise and visually with his shots, cinematic shots. I think, you know, CGI-wise, maybe it was just the low quality that we watched. I don't think it's quite holding up in this day and age.
It does not.
No.
A lot of movies don't, and that's okay. We just kind of have to watch them almost from a historical standpoint of when they were made. And I still think it's great.
Adam?
Yeah, I also watched this back around the time it came out, around 2007 or so, and I absolutely loved it. I still love it. I don't think I love it as much as I did when I first watched it. I'm not feeling as blown away as I was then. Part of that, I think, has to do with some of the story threads or the clunky plot in some areas where it just seems very hand-wavy or really trying to shoehorn some things in or some things aren't really followed up on. But the monster is still incredibly engaging. The family drama, which is the central theme in Bong Joon-ho's movies, is still very interesting and very fun to deal with. These actors are incredible. They're telling a really good story. The cinematography itself, outside of the really shitty version that we watched, is really cool. He like what he said, Bong Joon-ho does a really good job of setting up these shots and really telling a story with the shots themselves. And yeah, the monster was super cool. It does one of the issues you have with these kind of movies is a CGI ages well if they really try to use it to enhance something rather than make it the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
This monster was entirely CGI except for a very, very few scenes like taking place in the monster's mouth. But things like Jurassic Park, Troll Hunter, The Lord of the Rings, they use CGI to enhance something that is taking place in the dark or in shade or in the shadows. And it makes it ages much better. The Lord of the Rings still looks almost perfect over 20 years later.
Yeah.
And Gollum looks like a real thing. This monster is in the daylight almost all the time, full on, no hiding in the shadows for the most part, so it does not look great, but it is still a very convincing, very disturbing, and very cool monster.
And Dave, what did you think?
I loved it, and it's funny because I saw this movie in bits and pieces when I was a teenager, way back in the day, where I was like, oh, this is kind of fun. But this is the first time I ever sat down with my partner and we like watched this whole movie through, and having seen Parasite like a couple of months ago as well, you see those sort of same influences where you've got the crazy family mm-hmm. or the incompetent government services, like the scene where the guy in the yellow hazmat suit is trying to like walk by everybody and then slips and drops something at the funeral procession and everybody like turns and he's just like shit. And then they're like, hey, can you explain what's going on? And he goes, well, I'm pretty sure it's on the TV. You know what? I'll just turn the TV on. The TV will explain it. And then he turns it on and he's like, shit, it's not on yet. He's like, it'll be on soon enough. And then the gas starts coming in and he's like, oh, well, it's on now. And you know what? Just roll with it. And I liked it. I thought the monster was good. I mean, the CGI definitely does not hold up. But the acting does. The story is weird and quirky and stupid at so many parts that I wanted it to be. And... Mm-hmm. The realistic family, my partner, she was making this point last night. We were watching it and she's like, I love the idea of like families don't always get along. They don't always have these like perfect loving, they're holding each other relationships, but they've still got these like parental members that love every one of them for different reasons. And like every time that like one of them gets in on the other one, the father's stepping in. He's like, don't make fun of your brother for being a drunk. Don't make fun of your brother for sleeping. Don't make fun of your sister for not being able to shoot that arrow and taking too long. And it's like, it's really good. I liked it. I thought that it seemed to age really, really well in terms of just like a generally fun film.
Yeah, because it's one of those things that is a very common theme whenever people talk about this movie that's very obvious the more you learn about it. But it's less a monster movie and more a movie about a dysfunctional family taking place under the guise of a monster movie.
Into dysfunctional government, dysfunctional systems, mm-hmm. and dysfunctional groups of interacting governments. I love that we never figure out, because it looks like it's some sort of like doctor's office or post-mortem examination, which would make sense if it's some sort of area like a hospital with post-mortem facilities, why they have formaldehyde.
Looks like a morgue.
Right, because mm-hmm. it formaldehyde's a fixing agent. That's what we use it for. And
was it formalin or formaldehyde?
He says repeatedly it's formaldehyde.
Okay, I thought he specified formalin.
Yes, I mean, because he makes a comment at first. He's like, it's formalin. Formalin's more stable. And he's like, it's not formalin. It's formaldehyde, the embalming solution.
Gotcha.
And he's like, dump it. We never figure out, like, why are you dumping it? What's the point? And we don't really need an explanation. It's just this, like, superior being like, dump it. And then you just see bottle after bottle after bottle going into, yeah. like, the drain. Where you're also like, why didn't you just dump them all at once? Why are you doing them bottle by bottle? And I loved it.
Yeah, I will say that as someone who has worked with very dangerous chemicals during my own PhD work, there are an enormous amount of rules you have to follow when you're doing this. And first mm-hmm. and foremost, that dude he's wearing gloves. Great. That's cool. And you're dumping all these chemicals down the sink that is steaming and sizzling directly into your face that has no covering over your eyeballs. Yes. He has no covering over his eyeballs. His eyes would have been melted and stinging. I teach human anatomy. We work with rabbits that have been preserved in formalin, which is very similar to formaldehyde, and that stuff reeks. It gets in your eyes. It gets in your respiratory system. It mm-hmm. is not nice. You have to cover up. And he would have been crying or at the very least blind.
Come on, you wimp! Work that weasel! Quit holding that on us! Against my will, I'm going to knock it up another notch. Ooh, I got to get this notch up knocking on film. Hey, Elzar, think fast! Why you have...
I'm blind!
Bam!
So, I mean, I think this is a good segue to, before we get into our comments, thoughts, generally speaking, on the film. We all liked it, obviously. We thought the monster was fun and great.
Before we get too far into that, I just want to remind you, if you want to reach out to us and contact us with any questions, comments, concerns, amazing glowing reviews, You can reach out to us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. Sam is on Twitter at samperinntnu. I think that's still his name. If not, just look up Big Dr. Fishboy or Sam Perrin, P-E-R-R-I-N. You'll find him eventually. I'm at Hasek Adam. And then Dave and Libby are secret agents, so we can't tell you anything about that. Libby, where can they reach out to you for the short story soup?
I thought I was a secret agent.
You are, but your writing is not.
Yeah, if you want to check out my writings, you can go to www.shortstorysoup.substack.com.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Hey, so let's just get into the science stuff then and get into the fun of thoughts on this film. It sounds like Adam has some thoughts coming up.
Yeah, I think an interesting thing here is it's going to be a bit different as far as this monster, where normally we try to imagine these monsters as being real organisms that have evolved in a given habitat to have certain behaviors, certain looks, certain physiologies. But at least for the ecology side of this monster, I think it's going to be better to imagine this thing going forward, because this is very clearly an organism that is mutated from something else. And it's very ambiguous. It looks like a fish, looks like a frog, looks like a salamander. It is a very, very unique and super interesting creature design. But I don't think that we can try to argue that this has evolved from anything. This is a one-of-a-kind creature, much like last week's 11 Monsters, where these are all mutated organisms that aren't really coming from a stable population. So for my side, at least, of this, and Sam isn't here, so it's all me. Haha, I have the power. I think we just had to imagine what this thing would be going forward and what kind of organism it would then, what it would act like and what kind of habitat would be best for it. I think this is probably a salamander or frog, some kind of amphibian, because it is amphibious in nature. It's in the water, it's out of the water. It has that slick, that really slick skin, much like a salamander does. It looks like it's always wet, which it would have to be, so it can transport oxygen across its skin, which is how amphibians tend to breathe. And it's also a weird fusion, where there are literal fish stuck in its back.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. You know, we're talking about it as a mutation, but they also kind of hint that, like, maybe things have either, like, stuck to it or some sort of... I was going to ask y'all about this, of how these fish are, like, kind of glommed onto it, if that's, like, also making up the creature. Because we see at the very end a fish pop out of it, and the fish is still alive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's almost like it's still living... either on this organism, or is it a part of it?
Yeah, my first thought on that, when seeing it at the very beginning, where it's swimming through the water holding Hyunseo, is that her name?
Yeah.
Hyunseo, the daughter who gets kidnapped by the monster. You see it swimming, there are these fish tails that are obviously just the back half of a fish sticking out of its back. And my first thought on that was female anglerfish, which is, if you've seen Finding Nemo, it's the fish that tries to eat them in the dark. It's that fish that has the lure coming out of the rod on the top of its head with a light. Those are females. The males are much, much, much smaller, and they're basically, what they do is bite onto the female, get absorbed into her body, and just become this little nub that has a tail sticking out of the side of her that is basically just a glorified sack of sperm. Yeah, gonads.
Mm-hmm.
And she uses them to fertilize her eggs when she needs them, but they don't really exist beyond that. And that was my thought with this. That doesn't quite work if this is an amphibian, because a fish isn't going to be having babies with an amphibian. That's not how biology works. That's not how any of this works, no matter how much we try to stretch this. But, I think Libby's point about this being kind of a glom-together superorganism works because it has some very compounded features. Like, it's those tails are obviously multiple organisms.
Yep.
It sticking out of its back. It's... In some of the scenes where we see its, like, toes and claws that reach over the side of the grate when it looks down at Hyunseo, each of its toes looks like an individual foot from a different organism. So it's almost like you have all of these things kind of stacked together, making this one big monster, much like Destoroyah in the Godzilla movies.
Right. Which, of course, there's no root in physiology or ecology for creating a creature that sticks itself together. The closest...
No. What?
The closest that I could get from a basis of size and shape and everything, and we may explore this point, would be this creature in a much more traditional body plan, living somewhere that humans just haven't found it yet, further down the Han, that suffers serious carcinogenic mutations secondary to the formaldehyde, causing the deformities we see on the back, the deformities we see on the eyes, and causing neurological changes, which cause it to move further upstream for the first time and display abnormal behaviors, not representative of the original organism where it came from, which is why it's doing all these like strange out of place behaviors, because trying to generate a actual creature doesn't really make sense. And we can kind of talk about the formaldehyde element. Formaldehyde is a mutagen. It is a chemical mutagen. It can cause alterations to take place in your DNA, and it's a high-grade carcinogenic, generating tumors in humans, basically.
If you don't know, carcinogen means it causes cancer.
Yeah, which is why like you have to be so careful whenever we use it for sampling purposes or to try and like, I mean, again, most of the time we use formalin these days. But you have to be very careful not to make contact with your skin.
Is that why we use formalin now? To get away from formaldehyde?
I believe it's one of the reasons.
It's so dangerous.
Yeah, the more you know.
But the compound itself, it would not, there's no mechanism to cause a tadpole or a salamander to mutate into a, how big is that thing, do you think?
That thing is at least 10 meters long, if not more, so that close to 30 feet.
Right, so it's got to weigh probably the amount of like close to a rhino, based on like the traction and the way that it's running and generating, if not more.
Yeah, three to five tons, I would say. It's enormous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's no mechanism to cause a frog to generate a tumor that makes it the size of a rhino.
Yeah, kind of like what we were saying last week, and there are a lot of parallels between this and Love and Monsters last week, but mutations are not pretty. They don't give you superpowers. The X-Men are not a thing. A mutation, if it happens, normally doesn't do anything. If it does something, it's almost always bad. So the hosts, or the Guomil, the monster, its left eye is like this weird, lumpy, cataract-ridden, cancerous lump. That's what this entire thing would look like. It wouldn't be this big, scary, agile, flexible, prehensile tail-having monster with this multiple, symmetrical, like, compound jaw.
Yeah, I think when you were referencing pretty, just for our listeners, I think you even just mean more of like two even functional legs, two even functional arms. Yeah, not necessarily cosmetically beautiful, but
right. So we're going to ignore this is a monster that in 4 years humans have wrought upon themselves by dumping formaldehyde down. And I think it's probably easiest if we just pretend that it's some sort of giant creature that's just simply undergone cancerous or deleterious mutations.
Yeah. I think that's all it has to. We have to say that this is some previously undiscovered version of the Chinese giant salamander, which can be about 2 meters or 6 feet long. They're really, really big.
Cool.
But they're also really slow and they don't have teeth.
Do they swing from bridges?
They have prehensile tails.
You know, the only thing that has prehensile tails are primates, and specifically the monkeys, not apes. So no organism like this has a prehensile tail. Hey gang, Adam here. Just wanted to issue a quick correction on some statements made during this episode. I've put forward during this episode that only primates have evolved prehensile tails. This is not true. A number of non-primate organisms, such as opossums, chameleons, a ton of other mammals in particular, have evolved prehensile tails. And this is a form of life, or an adaptation rather, that is well-suited for arboreal lifestyles, so organisms that live in trees, and it's very handy for them to be able to wrap around a tree with not only their feet or hands, but also their tails. The host, this organism in this movie, it is still going to be too big to be able to use that small, small tail to be able to hold itself up in any meaningful way. So it still doesn't work, but we just want to issue that correction. Okay, back to the episode.
Right, so from a physiology perspective, just getting into the roots of it, I did really enjoy the whole like mutated, like it looks like the one eye is bad, the weird fins coming out, the strange sort of almost vestigial legs that are kind of hanging off.
Yeah,
sort of these like shrunken, shriveled, like, but they do have function, and the thing is still grabbing things with it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I never felt like the creature neurologically is okay.
It doesn't seem to be.
Like, it's sitting in the rain, gulping, it gulps the gasoline at the end, And even when it gets shot and it's like pretending to be dead, and then like, no, you not that. And when the humans like get up close to it, and the one guy's like, shoot it again, make sure that it's dead. And suddenly it like hops up and starts running again. But it's also unclear whether or not the bullets do anything to it. Like, we don't see it bleeding from bullet damage at any point.
No. The only time I think it ever bleeds is when he smashes its tail with that traffic sign.
The very beginning. Right. It's like bludgeoning damage.
And when he sticks it with the traffic sign again, when he uses it as the spear, he cuts it, and the first time we see the black blood. And then when he like sticks it at the end as it's trying to run away when it's on fire, we see all the blood like dripping down like the pole and across his hands.
Which is weird, because the blood is blue at the beginning of the movie.
See, I thought it was red.
When he smashed his tail, it was blue.
Oh, was it? Okay, because it's definitely black at the end. It is 100% yeah. black at the end.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of physiology problems going on with this.
A lot of ecology problems and evolution problems, too.
Good. So we're going to move past, just treat it, big creature, further down the bank, got hit with formaldehyde, caused some mutations, hence why it's got the cancerous eyes, it's got the weird fins coming out of it, whether or not they're actually fish or just pockets in the skin that fish have gotten trapped in. It is now this mutated, neurologically inappropriate thing. I think it's probably suffering from brain cancer. Now, in terms of its body plan, you can't walk on just your four limbs, pulling your entire body weight into the air in a well-balanced position.
No.
Every other species that takes on bipedal motion, even when like limbs are amputated in animals in veterinary medicine, it's always easier to lose a forelimb than it is to lose like a back limb. And
100%
watching this thing like run, like it would be dragging. Its weight doesn't work at all. Just looking at this thing, you're like, no. If I was trying to balance that on my finger, it would keep being bottom heavy. If its pelvic limbs were huge, we've got lots of examples. We've got kangaroos. We've got big groups of salamanders. Certain types of small mammals like chinchillas and other organisms can sort of
frogs.
Pop themselves up. Right, and they can primarily support themselves without having their front limbs touch ground. We have no natural mechanism for something that's been like, you know what? Fuck back limbs. I want to all go on my four limbs, like that giant guy at the gym who's just like, fuck leg day. And you're like, maybe a little leg day.
Maybe just some calf raises.
just do some running. Do something. Yeah, I think that this is... I did not realize until watching this again recently that this is a bipedal organism. I always thought that it moved on four legs.
Mm-hmm.
And then watching this, I'm like, oh, its back legs never touch. It's always the front.
Right. And then exactly as we were kind of discussing before. So it's seen repeatedly swinging seems to be its primary mode of locomotion. That also locomotion under the bridge, which also looks awkward as fuck. As it's like swinging from its tail from one area to the other and grabbing. So you can't do that. As a reptile also when you're that big, so...
Or an amphibian.
Amphibian, sorry. One of the coolest words that I love in the human language when it comes to talking about muscle and bone connections is the term syncsarcosis. So syncsarcosis in this context, referring to Adam, Libby, myself, we all have a collarbone that connects directly to the rest of our skeleton. It's how primates can swing, right? It's how monkeys can swing. Other animals, so your dog, your cat at home, their front limbs are just held on to the rest of their body by chunks of muscle and ligament. There's actually no bone connection because there doesn't have to be, right? Your back legs definitely need it, but your front limbs, there's no connection. Dogs' front limbs are completely disconnected because they're not swinging. They're not having to pull all that weight down.
What about the shoulder bone or the scapula?
Yeah, so you have like, so you've got your separate scapula, and then directly underneath that, you've got like the brachial plexus, you've got the series of muscles and ligaments that are over top of that, but there's no actual connection to, like, there's no collarbone. And cats have like felines have a false clavicle, but they don't actually have a direct connection to the rest of like their spine, their ribs, to the rest of their central skeleton.
Cool.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's also why it's a lot easier when it comes to amputation to take off a front limb than it is to take off a back limb.
Makes sense.
Because you can literally just undermine your way along the, just pop the thing off.
Pop
it's also
it off.
Why animals that are in car accidents oftentimes will take so much more front limb trauma, because it's a lot easier to do nerve and muscle and ligament damage because it's not connected. And the only reason we evolved a connection to it is because we swing. Like, if you're trying to carry all your weight, if you've ever been rock climbing before, that's why they tell you not to keep your arms bunched. You want to just kind of, like, hang, because we're designed for it. they're not. The idea that this creature is swinging back and forth and then catching itself with just its forelimbs to then get its tail into alignment again to swing again, I see no mechanism for that. And I mean, if it does connect it to the rest of its skeleton, I just wouldn't understand why. Because like, there wouldn't be trees or anything that I could think of that would be big enough. It looks like a primary aquatic organism. There'd be no reason to evolve that feature.
It's built like a massive crocodilian. And Libby made a really good point when we were watching this, that its legs are even slung out sideways like a massive crocodilian's is. They don't tend to support their body weights like that, except for very, very short bursts of speed. They just lie on their stomach with their limbs out to the side.
Right.
It's just, it does not make sense for this thing to be trying to do any kind of arboreal or hanging or swinging movement.
Now, there are a bunch of cool things. Now, Libby, did you feel from a story perspective that swinging really added to this film? Like, because trying to watch it, I never really was like, oh, that would be the part that as a director, I'd be like, if you don't put my swinging reptile in, I am walking away from this sack of shit right now.
I think it was done just to give it a little bit of spice. I think movement wise, you know, from swimming or running, this thing was obviously not struggling. Very powerful in that aspect. You know, he showed in the beginning scene, especially, like, you cannot run this thing. It's super fast.
Yeah.
And seems to have a fuck ton of stamina as well. So it's not like a crocodile. Well, you just like kind of have those short bursts. So I think it was just done to sort of add like a cool, different aspect from it. But no, I don't think it was necessary.
Right. Did you feel it added that? I'm a very biased standpoint, but watching it, I never at any point watching it like awkwardly swing over the bridge was like, that's so cool. I was just like, oh, I hate this so much.
I think it did, honestly. Okay. I think what it added was it made it more treacherous as an ambush predator. You know, because that's how it seemed to primarily hunt. Much like a crocodile, you just see it kind of in the water. I think by adding that layer of like, it could be in the water, but it could also be above you, you know, ready to strike at any moment, kind of added a little bit more danger for the characters rather than just like stay away from the water edge.
I think for me personally, that kind of took me out of the movie because we only see one example of it being an ambush predator, and it seems to be more happenstance than anything. It's a very large leap in logic for me for these guys to have stopped those two sanitation workers who get yoinked by the creature swinging down and ambushing them, like Libby was just saying, by they happen to see, like, I think it's some money on the side of the road, and one of them is like, oh, this is sweet. He goes to pick it up, and the other guy's like, we should get out of here. And the creature swings down and gets them, but are they implying that the creature put the money there to trap people? Was it just happened to sleep there and it saw the people stop under them? I don't think this form of ambush works. We see it at the beginning of the movie. The very first scene is hanging from the bridge like a bat, kind of hanging out, and then it drops off into the water. So maybe this is how it sleeps, but it also sleeps. Well, it was a trap at the end of the movie when it's sleeping on the ground.
But it is sleeping there. Like, as much as it's a trap, I mean, it's also very clear.
It's able to rest. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, obviously. I will say, for things that I really liked from this movie, the fact that we don't see it submerging for long periods of time, but like when it swims, whenever it comes into the cavern, it's got a traditional, like, its head is kind of above water. Its nostrils aren't right for how they're supposed to be for bringing in, but it is.
Does it have nostrils?
It does. Yeah, I rewatched it a couple of times. They're very small, and they look much more similar to what we'd see like on a frog or a toad. Sort of centralized around the face. They're not up, they're not out of the water, but at least the creature is swimming. Like, I mean, we can see it. It's not submerging and diving for big long periods of time. Mm-hmm. And they're like, it's managed to be both underwater and above.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that. As Adam has already brought up, the prehensile tail would not work under any circumstances. It's also way too long and it's doing a whole bunch of different things.
Oh my God. This man is my exact double! That dog has a puffy tail!
I wanted a question, I guess, from you guys. Did you get the impression that this creature was smart watching the film?
It varies. I think that there's moments there's a very obvious moment at the end where it tricks Hyun-seo by pretending to be asleep, and it grabs her when she tries to climb up. And they're trying to imply, I think, that it is smart, but I don't think it is, nor could it be, as far as, if it, especially if it's suffering from brain cancer and there's a giant tumor in there that's going to affect your cognition? I just think this thing, especially the opening scene, it's flailing around, running around like right. crazy. I don't think that there's any kind of directed intelligence there.
Yeah, I think for me, from a story perspective, it was a little scattered. You have moments where it just seems to act very animalistic, you know, grabbing and thrashing and you know, chomping and whatnot. And then you have a couple scenes where it seems to be a little bit smarter of a predator. I had also a big problem concerning the tail is sometimes it's able to use it to pinpoint accuracy. And then other times it seems like it can't use it at all. So there's a couple scenes where one, the sister Namju gets knocked down into this like cement crevice kind of thing in the bridge. And up until this point, the creature has been using its tail, you know, willy-nilly to grab people, you know. And yet it can't reach down with it to grab her.
Ooh, that's a good point, yes.
And then also even in its lair with Hyunseo, the tunnel, that there's sort of like this sewage right. pipe that they're hiding in. And it could easily
reach the tail,
you know,
and
fit
and grab
its
them.
Tail and then grab her. You know, and you see it, you know, grab her with the tail later. So I just, to me, it was kind of all over the place with its intelligence and how it uses, you know, predator tactics versus intelligence or, you know, whatever. I think to me, the funny, the weird tactile rain, water in the face sensation, it was comical to me because it made it seem pretty dumb. Like you said, like have some sort of neurological issue, which was odd.
So what would have worked better for you from a story perspective if they were thinking about fixing that? Like just have it more dumb the entire film, or would it be more terrifying if it did seem to display some degree of intelligence?
You know, I think it would have been more terrifying. I think obviously always having more intelligence in an animal is going to be scarier.
Always.
Always. However, I think for this movie, it doesn't really matter. Because the bulk of this movie isn't even about the monster.
Except for the monster as humans.
The monster's just sort of this, like, this side story. And even the government is not hunting the monster at all. They're mostly fixated on the virus that the monster brings.
Right, trying to find the virus or find examples of the virus.
Yeah, they're not setting up any sort of barrier or, you know, like as you would see in American monster movies, immediately guns and military, like trying to hunt this thing. There's nothing. No protection under the bridges. Like nobody really cares. So I think it really didn't matter because it was just this one monster versus this very dysfunctional family. So I think it could have been stupid and it would have been fine.
Yeah.
Now the larder storing, the trying to keep the organism somewhere that it can come back and eat them, does kind of make sense if they're dead. In terms of like this thing clearly is, so I did a lot of reading on frog digestion yesterday, just because I figured that was kind of the coolest part of this creature clearly isn't chewing up its prey. It's eating them whole and it's relying on the same idea that frogs do, which is powerful muscles in the back of the throat that basically squeeze something, shut off the oxygen and then drop it into the stomach where regurgitation processes can take place. Digestion. Sorry. And the African bullfrog is one of these species, which terrifying, watched enough videos of that, which was nightmare fuel before bed, of yep. watching it eat mice and seeing like how that process works. And it does the same thing, right? The mouse is either bludgeoned or eaten. It is alive technically when it's pulled in, but the constrictions block its ability to breathe, eventually drop it into the gastric juices, and it's more or less dead by the time that it gets there. And then digestion takes place. It's pushed through. Now, a lot of the undigestible stuff just simply comes out the cloacal vent, the opening, the frog asshole, for lack of a better word.
At the one size fits all exit.
Is that right. the scientific term?
I don't have a better one. Adam might have a better one.
It's like the Swiss Army knife of orifices. You can use it for reproduction. You can use it for shitting. You can use it for urinating. It does it all.
It does do it all. And so that mechanism, to me, kind of watching that made sense. And super cool, just as a side note, because you know how we love highlighting animals that we think are awesome and badass. There is a type of newt. So it's called the rough skin newt, which is eaten. So it gets itself eaten by big frogs. And then once it's been ingested, it actually has a toxin that's present in its skin. So it gets eaten. It's alive. It gets into the frog's stomach where it releases these toxins into the digestive juices that are rapidly absorbed through the walls of the stomach. It then kills the frog. And then this cool little newt just simply climbs its way back out of the frog's mouth.
Is the theory behind this a behavior or a trait that was selected for? Or is this just happened to happen? This just sometimes happens whenever a frog eats it. It just dies from being poisoned.
I think it's supposed to be an evolutionary protective mechanism. But, I mean, covering yourself in toxin substances, so things that eat you either throw you back up or are toxined or poisoned. It's just generally speaking, if Adam has to go running through the forest with a whole bunch of things that eat him, if he wants to just cover himself in a whole bunch of toxic chemicals beforehand, it's probably a good protective mechanism.
Oh, this is my favorite event. Catch the greased up deaf guy.
Go!
You're never gonna catch me. You're wasting your time. Forget about it. Go do something else. See you next year.
Yeah, it's one of those really cool things of a co-evolutionary arms race where you have two organisms that are adapting to each other, and it just results in these incredibly heightened traits, be it a ability to resist toxins or an ability to create more and more and more deadly toxins. And these newts are really good examples of it because they create what is called tetrodotoxin, and it's something that newts specifically make that is one of the most deadly toxins in the world. And in North America, at least, especially in the Pacific Northwest, you have these newts that have this co-evolutionary arms race with garter snakes, which are these toads or frogs, swallow them whole. And as a result, these populations of garter snakes have evolved this resistance to this toxin, but these newts are also becoming more and more and more toxic. So if you're in North America and you pick up a newt, wash your hands before you do anything else because you might be poisoning yourself. There's a really good story, actually, of a group of, I don't know if this is the 1800s or 1900s, but basically a bunch of cowboys out on the range, and they found these four guys just around a campfire dead. Just, they don't know what had happened to them, but the theory is that one of these newts crawled into their cooking pot, poisoned their food, and they all just died in the middle, really quickly, in the middle of nowhere.
God, the American West was terrifying.
Still is.
Yeah. Now, obviously, these people are not covered in toxic things to help them survive the jowls of our creature. But Adam has a good theory. I was asking him, why do we think the two little kids, there's Hyunseo and a little boy, I forget his name.
I think that might be, if we're looking at these, the IMDb correctly.
Seju?
Jinse or Seijin? Oh, that's him. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, Seju.
Seju.
So there's two little kids that survive. In the larder, we see all these dead bodies, skulls, things like that, but two kids survive. So Adam, you want to talk about how that might be possible?
Yeah, I think that one of these things with this creature that has been, like, we see at the very beginning of the movie too, like, switch out a body, like, it throws up that fat kid and then swallows Hyunseo and then brings her and the fat kid back to the larder. The fat kid is dead. Hyunseo is not, and neither in this kid's brother gets killed by the creature, but he throws up the little boy, Seijin. Seijin's his brother. I think what is happening is that whenever this creature is swallowing a human being, it is kind of hanging out in its gullet somewhere. Be that, I don't think it'd be the stomach because it would be digesting, but it's somewhere in its esophagus. And this thing doesn't move around like humans do. It's almost like a snake or like an amphibian, like a salamander. They have that very sinusoidal wave-like movement, like a slithery, slimy snake. And adults, because they're bigger, are going to get crunched up and bent in ways that are not very healthy for our skeleton or our nervous system, and it would break their spine.
Especially if you're moving with the tail and crunching that way as well, right? Not just moving in the water, but if it's like hanging off, it's got somebody in its gullet and crunching upwards as it's swinging with its...
Upwards and backwards.
I agree. Tail. I think it's probably fractures. It's also probably just respiratory constriction. You're small enough that your little lungs, if you're little, you'll have more space to breathe out. These big adults are going to find themselves in situations where the muscles of the whatever this thing has for an esophagus is going to be enough to push in on these big adults and stop them from breathing. And I wonder if the kids are going to be able to escape this to a certain degree. They're going to have more space for sort of quick breaths until they get regurgitated and sort of brought back up. And it looks like it's an irritation is bringing up the regurgitation. So owls... big predators, they produce pellets, right? They chomp something, all the fur the bone, the other material, it gets moved through the stomach, gets digested, and then it gets into the second stomach and the gizzard, where that material can't be done anymore. It's pushed back up into the stomach and then eventually regurgitated, right? They're not going to push that material through. It's just too dangerous for them. That clearly isn't happening here because we're not seeing a formed pellet. We're not seeing the material all compressed down when the bones and the skeleton and the other thing, when that thing hangs itself over top of the concrete vent and brings up all of that material. So more likely, we've all run into this situation with like our cat where it's eaten a mouse and it sort of comes back and it digests it. And then suddenly it throws up like pieces of it, like chunks of the fur mm-hmm. or chunks of like the bone and the other material. It's probably got some mechanism in place. That material that starts to create enough irritation that isn't passing through the bottom area of the stomach, the pylorus, into the lower intestines, creates enough irritation that it triggers a regurgitation response, which is what we're seeing with this thing, which is why it's sometimes bringing up material. The kids kicking around or moving or doing whatever they're doing is generating enough irritation, and why it's only sort of partially digesting certain animals. I mean, it doesn't have any good rhyme or reason, because at one point as well, when it's trapped in the trailer, you see all those people getting bloody as they're just getting like chunked to pieces by this thing. And you're like, mm-hmm. is it eating them? Is it not eating them? But then it also like knocks the father over and smashes him with the tail. And then it like looks at it and it's like, nah, I don't want to eat that. And it like wanders over and you're like, but it's dead. Shouldn't you have eaten it? You did a lot of work to get that food. Neurologically, maybe you're not okay.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense from that point of view. Animals don't waste food. They don't kill for the sake of killing, except for cats. Keep your cats inside. There's no way we can make this work ecologically or evolutionarily. But I think it's most interesting to talk about these weird behaviors and traits that have been conglomerated onto this one amphibious reptilian thing, where, like an owl, like Dave is saying, it swallows prey, throws up, not a pellet, but it throws up skeletons, so bones, way too many bones to be holding at once.
Way too many bones.
This thing could hold maybe one adult, maybe an adult and a child, but one adult max.
But it pukes up like...
Like tons, like
12
dozens,
skeletons.
Yeah. Dozens right. of skeletons.
So maybe there's a mechanism by which it's holding bones for a longer period of time in its stomach, but then it raises the question of why is it regurgitating some stuff and not regurgitating others? We don't mm-hmm. actively right. see it eating from the larder all the time in terms of those bodies that it's brought in, but it still seems to be bringing more. But then the bodies do go missing. And when we see that thing sleeping, it's like sleeping in the corner. It could be digesting. We know that large reptiles go through periods where they eat, and then there's a huge amount of energy that has to go into digesting and breaking down whatever the large amounts are. Maybe that's why it's so comatose.
It would make sense.
And it's just kind of a reflex that its tail goes off and catches her. But yes, we're making a stretch to make that work.
Yeah, so it's got that weird behavior, and then it has, like Dave has mentioned, the larder, which makes sense, like Eleanor's falcon, which we talked about during the Outlander episode, which is a horrendously brutal organism that will rip the wings off of its prey, other birds, and stuff them into a little rock cubby so that way it can preserve them for later so they're still fresh and alive. This thing is maybe not purposely, but it is killing its prey and then dumping them in this larder, which does not make sense from the point of view of keeps amassing these its prey, these humans, which are going to be rotting and going bad over time, so it's increasing mm-hmm. its chances of getting sick or picking up a disease of some kind, so that doesn't quite work. It's almost like a shrike, which is a small bird here in North America. Look it up, they're really cool. I think we might have mentioned them on the Outlander episode as well, but what they do is they will take their prey organisms, frogs, other smaller birds, and impale them on cacti, like the thorns mm-hmm. of cacti, or nowadays, barbed wire fences. And they do this not only to save food for later, but to mark their territory or to show off for females. So maybe this is some kind of weird behavioral thing where it's trying to amass trophies to show off for a potential mate that will never come. But I don't know.
Do shrikes, when they do that, do they have some sort of mechanism that helps them understand which food is, like, when they have those bodies, can they tell which ones are good to eat or which ones are, like, too rotten at this point? Or how do they
discern? I don't know.
I would assume so.
Maybe they're just hoping they dry out over time. I don't actually know why that would be a beneficial.
Making jerky?
Yeah, they might be making jerky. I don't know enough. I don't know a lot about shrikes, but from my understanding of it, most predators specifically need to eat very, very fresh meat or they're going to get sick.
Yeah.
Because bacteria set in, disease will set in very quickly. That's why you have an entire class of organisms that are adapted to eat things that are dead.
Yeah. Well, and that's like leopards too. They bring their dead things up into the trees. But it's not like a huge amount of bodies. It's just usually one or two.
And they'll pick at it for a while.
Right. Well, that's also because hyenas are dicks.
Yeah.
And lions.
But yeah, I mean, maybe I was thinking as I was watching it, there's an external digestive process where, you know, it has to start something and then it spits them up. We've talked about species like that before, but there's no corrosion going on the body. There's no obvious breakdown. The little girl is totally fine. The mechanism wouldn't make sense.
No.
And then the last sort of point that I guess I wanted to chat with you guys about is just the creature's untimely end. Sort of in terms of the release of that chemical. So I know Adam is, as a parasitologist, definitely going to have thoughts on what you think about releasing a chemical that's supposed to just wipe out all living animals within a certain space and having groups of humans standing around with masks on being like, yeah, we'll be fine.
It's one of those things that is obviously, I think, a tongue-in-cheek. Bong Joon-ho, I think, did this on purpose to make the government look like idiots, or the people protesting to look like idiots, because it's obviously a very thinly veiled reference to Agent Orange, which is a chemical compound they used during the Vietnam War, which is incredibly bad, caused a shit ton of birth defects. It was incredibly dangerous. I think there's still a lot of it in Vietnam, I think.
Maybe
thinking of landmines.
No, we're still seeing secondary mutations. It's still like, I mean, the main reason they used it was just simply removing plant life so they could better see the Viet Cong when the Americans came in for their attacks. But the secondary, again, teratogenic and carcinogenic effects on humans, so mutating babies and causing cancer, still continues to be a major problem to this day.
Right. So that's what this is obviously a reference to. But having this kind of chemical weapon does not make sense because they're dropping it in the middle of a populated city. I don't know if this is supposed to be Seoul, but this is obviously a very large metropolitan center, and this is a windborne chemical. It doesn't matter if you're trying to isolate it. You're going to be poisoning everyone in this city and the countryside for a very long time. And you see it from the very beginning. Wind is blowing it immediately.
Well, yeah, it's like leaking from the... it's automatically already in the air, even though they haven't, you know, quote-unquote released it.
The little announcement from it saying, you know, if you can hear this, right, you need to move further away. It's like, it doesn't matter how far away you're moving. You're not going to be able to move fast enough to get away from this chemical.
Right.
I did find it interesting, and I'm not sure if this was on purpose, but when we see the opening shot of the monster hanging under the bridge, to me, I saw a direct visual parallel with that shot at the end of the bag of Agent Yellow hanging. Ooh, it looked very similar to the shape of the monster.
That's a really good point. It does.
So I think to me, narratively, maybe I'm adding way too much into this. it's sort of that parallel of which one is the real monster, you know, the actual monster or the government.
It's a really good point.
Yeah, that is. The chemicals do appear to have some sort of contact reaction with the creature, because we see it gets hit by the thing and then it takes burns. But interestingly enough, no one else does. And I don't know if that's, maybe it's just rooted from an amphibian. Its skin is more reactive when it comes to these types of topical chemicals.
And it would be.
Right. And the humans are just all going to get cancer later.
Well, we do see them bleeding from their nose and ears.
Some of them. Not all.
Some. I missed that.
It's very inconsistent with the effects of what this chemical is doing to living organisms. I think the idea behind the Agent Yellow to begin with is that it's used to kill biological weapons, which... if they're concerned about a virus is not a biological thing. It's not going to work. You can't use an antibiotic to kill a virus. You use antivirals. So that is a whole other issue to begin with.
Right. And antivirals don't even, from a contact perspective, I mean, there's still a big discussion, as Adam was bringing up at the beginning, are viruses alive or dead? They're a small chunk of DNA usually transmitted by some type of protein sequence, which we draw really cool pictures for. But in terms of, it's basically just a protein sheath with a ton of DNA that sticks onto something, injects its own DNA, which causes replication, creates more of itself, and then it ruptures and continues to move, right? HIV, influenza.
It looks like a light bulb with spider legs
right
on it.
I mean, depending on exactly what their protein sequences are. And we know they're incredibly resistant. They're difficult to see. That's why viruses are such a problem. That's why kids get sick every year at school and parents just kind of have to deal with it. Like, they're viruses.
This is why there are COVID variants already.
So releasing an agent and being like, we're pretty sure it's going to wipe out, unless what they're trying to do is just wipe out all life in the surrounding area long enough for the virus sequences to become inactive. If there's no host to transmit. But then that raises really big problems of, as we've talked about on this podcast before, viruses are really specific. If you want to get into an organism in order to make it replicate more parts of yourself, you need to know its genetic code really, really well, which means you can't be a generalist. You can't affect everything. That's why, like, I mean, this is a big problem all the time. People bring their cats in. Cats, very often, a large percentage of the feline population is affected by herpes. And it's what causes most of those runny eyes, those occasional sneezing that you see. And cats just have their bad herpes days. And I will say 90% of the time when I bring this up, I have owners immediately pull their hands away from their cat and they go, whoa, 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 my cat has herpes. And it's like, no, not, yes, it has a herpes simplex virus. Not that herpes. Like, you don't have to worry.
You might
worry.
Also have feline AIDS. You're not going to get AIDS from your cat.
Right. And if your partner has told you that you got the herpes from your cat, you may need to rethink who your partner is.
Reevaluate that relationship.
Yes. Yes, these are good points.
So, yeah, I mean, in terms of maybe that's the mechanism, but again, I think a lot of it is exactly as you guys were pointing out, the tongue-in-cheek element of just the government. And Libby, I feel like that story was pretty well delivered, that they weren't trying to make it look like this was a serious attempt by either the Korean or the American government to actually do anything. This also very much felt like the Americans being like, we have a new toy. We want to try it out. We need an excuse to try it out.
Consequences be damned.
Right.
Yeah. In a different country, for sure.
I mean, why would you test it out on your own soil?
Yeah. And we see this too with the narrative with the doctors, you know, even aside from the chemical, with them wanting to experiment on these brain surgeries with both the, you know, patient zero and then the main guy, Gong-Doo, I think his name is, Park. So, you know, them saying consequences be damned, we just want to do this because we have the power.
Yeah.
Want to try our shiny new toy?
Good evening, my fellow Americans. By the power vested in me, your new national security advisor, I declare our country at war again. But who are we at war with, you ask? Why box ourselves in by declaring a single enemy? Imagine a world where there is no world.
And then the last question I think I wanted to ask both of you guys, because I got a resounding no from my partner last night while watching this. I spent the entire movie feeling bad for this monster and being like, oh, the poor mutated thing. It looks lost. It looks scared. And then when they like hunt it down at the end and they like set it on fire and then they stab it. And I honestly, I was feeling bad for the monster the entire time. And I asked my partner last night and she was like, no, I don't feel bad for the monster. It's eating people. She's like, what if the monster ate me? And I was like, well, I wouldn't be mad at the monster, which generated a near sleeping on the couch situation. The question that I'm asking of you guys is, am I alone in this sensation?
Well, I think for me, I tend to be an animal lover, so I always feel bad for the animal, even if they are.
Yes.
I was the kid, the weird kid that root, like when I was younger, I would root for the lions to catch the antelope. Because so many kids don't realize, you know, like mama lion's gotta eat too, you know? So, it, you know, obviously in nature, it's everything's got to eat and survive. And this creature is certainly no different. It's just trying to do its thing. And I think for me, especially seeing the neurological problems, you know, I think the rain thing, well, I say rain, but it even does it with the gasoline at the end where he's just sort of like enjoying this little shower. I think it's adorable. You know? He's just kind of like taken in the environment in his little fresh shower. So I think, yeah, that especially made me feel a little bit more sympathetic to this thing. Just being a victim also in this narrative.
Yeah. Adam?
I think that I'm in a weird in-between spot where this is obviously an organism that is out of its depth. It should not be there. It doesn't know what's going on. It's not to blame. But it is also effectively an invasive species and a very dangerous one at that. Mm-hmm. This is not like people going to where crocodiles live and we have to, you know, we should kill the crocodiles because they're dangerous. It's like, well, you came to the crocodile spot. This is an organism that has been created accidentally, but created in a major population center. It is an incredible risk to not only people, but whatever else is living in the river. It's going to be eating all the fish, if there are any fish there. It looks like a polluted mess. But if there's anything alive in there, it's going to be eating it. So I think it's one of those things where, at the risk of sounding like a ridiculous science fiction movie, it shouldn't exist. It needs to die. So I think that I feel bad for it, but it also needs to be removed.
You don't think we could find a little zoo for it?
A zoo? Yeah, sure.
A little enclosure where it can live out its life.
If we could find a way to safely get it somewhere, absolutely. Keep it alive, make it happy. But if you can't, it needs to be killed, I think. Cold is the would be the proper management term that sounds nicer.
Yeah. So, I mean, I very much felt for it when it was on fire and it's running and I'm like, it's almost in the water. And then the dickhead stabs it.
That is, oh my God. This thing is, we're saying, probably 3 to 5 pounds. Now imagine poor little Park Gung-doo.
You mean tons?
Tons.
Yeah,
he meant
tons. Tons. Tons, which is 3,000 to 5,000 kilos, 6,000 to 10,000 pounds. More than that, actually. And Park Gung-doo runs, stands in front of it, doesn't brace himself against anything, and just holds up this little traffic sign pole and stops it dead in its tracks. It shows him, like, being pushed a little bit. He would be in the fucking water.
Well, and they showed to the end, it didn't even impale his hand. Yeah, it would have gone right through it. Like a little impression circle in his palm. I feel like this, throughout the entire movie, though, he's shown some rather beastly strength, so maybe Rue.
I mean, maybe he's the Hulk. Maybe the virus made him strong.
Maybe the formaldehyde, he was infected, too.
They never explained why the sedative didn't work on him.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a superhero origin story that we just didn't get to hear.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's probably like the little... We might talk about it whenever we do Cloverfield, but I feel like there's a weird parallel between the human being infected and the monster itself also doing stuff.
I mean, and I think that's... From a storyline perspective, I think that's plausible. I mean, we see him survive... brain surgery, lobotomy. We see him just, you know, survive the anesthesia. It doesn't have any effect on him. And clearly he also has some neurological issues going on, maybe with narcolepsy and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, it's possible that he has also been impacted by this pollution in a superhero kind of way.
Yeah.
Come on, be honest with yourself. At some point in our lives, we all want to be a superhero. That's not me, by the way. That's some Armenian guy with a history of mental health problems. Who am I? I'm Kick-Ass.
But I think, wrapping up, I would just ask the two of you, would you recommend this movie?
Yes. I mean, I think you'd have to get someone, though, who enjoyed Parasite or enjoyed, like, the dysfunctional family and kind of does a little bit of a suspension of disbelief for the characters and the government and is willing to watch this kind of, like, as you guys pointed out, weird, dysfunctional family fighting a virus, bribing people with boxes full of quarters kind of film.
Yeah, I will say this movie is a lot more satirical. If people have seen only Parasite by Bong Joon-ho, this movie is way more satirical. So it goes over the top, a little outlandish in scenes. So it's supposed to be a lot more comical. So if you enjoy satire, you enjoy monster movies, and just kind of a fun paced action adventure almost, then yes, I would absolutely recommend this.
And enjoy the justice that gets obtained for when somebody eats one of your squid legs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Did you want to add if you liked it or would recommend it?
I would absolutely recommend it. I think that to Libby's point, it is going to be a bit different than you might expect. It's not a straight up and down monster movie. And I think the scene that will make or break people is the funeral scene where they're all at the little wake and they're just
trying to
one-up each other with screaming and pretending to cry,
yelling
and flailing
and punching
around
each other.
Ground.
Yeah.
And if you can appreciate that for what it is, you will love this movie. If that is going to make you want to get up and leave the movie, you're not going to enjoy this movie.
Yeah, that's fair.
Can Stitch say goodbye?
Yes. Thank you. Who are you?
This is my family. It's little and broken, but still good. Yeah, still good.
Well, then, I think that's good. We've moved through all our stuff. We've survived an episode without Sam. And wrapping up and moving on, Adam, do you want to give our little tag phrase to get us out of here?
Absolutely. Remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
I've heard your daughter's still alive.
Why didn't you contact the police or the military, a human rights organization, something?